May it please the court, Joshua Levine on behalf of the petitioner Reginald Clements. Your Honors, the issue before you here is quite simple. Judge Manners found that Mr. Clements was prejudiced because the state suppressed compelling evidence that his confession was coerced. And the only question here is whether the court should adopt that finding or whether it can allow Mr. Clements' conviction and death sentence to stand, even though that confession was central to the case against him, and even though, after hearing all of the testimony from all of the relevant witnesses and assessing their credibility, Judge Manners concluded that the police did, in fact, coerce the confession, just as he concluded that it was blindingly obvious that they had also beaten Thomas Cummins, the key witness in the case against Mr. Clements. I'd like to just spend a minute talking about the evidence that the state suppressed, because it's a pretty remarkable story. In 2012, nearly 20 years after Mr. Clements was convicted, a former state bail investigator named Warren Weeks came forward with evidence that the state had intentionally withheld and doctored evidence corroborating Mr. Clements' claim that he was beaten by the police.
In the petition that was filed in this court, is there any mention of Weeks or this evidence at all?
No, Your Honor, because we did not learn of the Weeks evidence until nearly 3 years after the petition was filed.
Did you ever amend the petition?
We did not, Your Honor. But Judge Manners obviously allowed us to present the evidence of it and considered it in his findings. Weeks was interviewing Mr. Clements and filling out a pretrial release form, as was his job as a bail investigator. And he observed a large bump on Mr. Clements' face just a few hours after Mr. Clements was interrogated by the police. He was troubled by this, and he made a note of it on the pretrial release form. He also told his supervisor. A little while later, he was called into another supervisor's office who tried to convince Mr. Weeks that he hadn't seen what he had seen. After that, Mr. Weeks was called into the prosecutor's office, Nels Moss. Mr. Moss also tried to convince him that he hadn't seen the marks on Mr. Clements' face. But what Nels Moss did not do was turn over to the defense the evidence of what Weeks had seen. Even though Moss would later admit in the proceeding before Judge Manners that he would assume that such evidence would be important to the defense. And worse, as Judge Manners also concluded, someone from the state actually doctored the pretrial release form, scratching out Mr. Weeks' note detailing the bump on Mr. Clements' face. Now, there's no question that this evidence was favorable to Mr. Clements. Judge Manners concluded that it obviously was favorable, and the state hasn't disputed that. The state has also conceded that the evidence wasn't turned over to the defense. And so the only issue before this court is whether the evidence was prejudicial under Brady. And there's no question that it was. Judge Manners clearly so found his finding.
Before we talk about prejudice, let's talk about disclosure again. He was listed as a witness, right?
Yes.
So the defense team obviously knew that he was involved and had, or at least the prosecutor at some point, thought he had some information of relevance.
Well, there was no indication that there was any information that he had that would have been helpful to the defense. I mean, he was just one of numerous law enforcement witnesses who were initially listed, but he was never actually obviously called as a witness.
How many people knew that Weeks had seen a bump on Mr. Clements' face?
I guess Mr. Weeks obviously knew it. There were two supervisors he mentioned it to, and the prosecutor, Nels Moss, himself. So those were the people who
There's one
it.
More.
Sorry?
There's one more. Clements knew it.
Well, I can't say that that's right, Your Honor. I mean, Clements was obviously processed by a million different people. There certainly was no reason for Mr. Clements to think that this one law enforcement officer, as opposed to all the other law enforcement officers who were keeping this wall of silence, would have come forward and said anything along those lines.
But he at least knew who he had seen that morning.
I don't think it's a, I mean, he saw a lot of people. I don't think he would have been able to know all the names of the different people that processed him during the course of that evening. I think it's an unfair burden to place on a defendant when the state is in possession of evidence not only about who processed him, but about the fact that one of those people observed evidence that the police physically coerced him.
Of course, Mr. Clemens wouldn't have known about the doctored form, or that Mr. Moss had gone to see him, or that he talked to two supervisors and none of that had been turned over.
That's precisely right, Your Honor. You know, even if he was on any kind of notice, which I contest that and would say he was not, of the fact that Mr. Weeks observed the injuries, he certainly had no way of knowing of the doctored form, which, in fact, you know, the form has never been produced to the defense in an undoctored fashion, and the defense only got the form with the crossout during the federal habeas proceeding in 1998. So there was certainly no way for the defense to have that. Now,
the master did make a finding that Mr. Clemens was not actually innocent, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And specifically asked you whether or not, although there were some initial pleadings during the process, asked you whether or not you were claiming that Mr. Clemens was actually innocent, and you indicated that you were not, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I would say this to that. I mean, I think we originally brought the petition alleging actual innocence in part as a gateway to get these claims before the court. Obviously, events overtook us, and we're now here making a cause and prejudice argument based on information that we learned during the course of this proceeding.
You pursued Brady rather than actual innocence as the gateway to looking.
That's precisely right, Your Honor. So there's no need to get to actual innocence. I mean, as a factual matter, Mr. Clemens continues to assert his innocence, but you don't need to get there for the court to find that there's been a constitutional violation here and that Mr. Clemens is entitled to a new trial. And the state, you know, as I've indicated, the only component of this that the state has contested is whether or not there was prejudice suffered here by Mr. Clemens.
In regard to prejudice, it seems that the Brady, a constitutional Brady right, comes from the right to fair trial. And as I understand your argument, this material would have possibly changed the outcome of the hearing regarding the motion to suppress, but that you don't argue that it would have changed, was likely to change the outcome of the trial.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. We argue that, and Judge Mantner so found, that there is a reasonable likelihood that the entire outcome of the trial would have been different had this evidence been turned over.
Well, wasn't that based? Yeah, I can't find that. It looks like to me that your argument and his finding was that if the judge would have considered this evidence, there's a possibility that the judge would have sustained the motion to suppress, which is quite different than if this evidence would have been presented at trial. There was a possibility that it would have changed the outcome of the trial.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, maybe we're speaking past each other. I think the finding that Judge Manners made was that if this evidence of the coerced confession had been turned over to the defense, there is a reasonable likelihood that Mr. Clemens would not have been convicted.
Well, now, and here, my question is, it's yes. Actually maybe more simple than that, is you seem to focus on whether or not the motion to suppress regarding this Clemens statement would have been suppressed. And my question from a legal perspective is that the proper analysis, or is the analysis under Brady whether or not if this evidence would have came in at trial, it would have been outcome determinative?
Well, I think that the relevant evidence under Brady is if this evidence was turned over to the defense, is there a reasonable likelihood that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different?
The reason I question that is that it seems like from the U.S. Supreme Court case in Ruiz that they're looking at Brady as a fair trial claim. And so, for example, Brady material has been held not to apply, for example, at the plea stage. In other words, if the state did not disclose Brady type of material and a defendant went ahead and pled guilty, that we look at it as a trial right. It's not something that happened pre-trial. I'm trying to see how you distinguish those cases and the Federal Circuit cases along that line.
Well, I think that that's a different situation. I mean, here this is actually part of the trial proceeding. It's the suppression hearing, you know, is happening in the lead up to the trial. And I think that even